Okay, we're good to go. Good to be with you this morning. Matthew 19, verse 1. So keep that open, page 986 of those blue Bibles. Okay. In America, prenuptial agreements are recognised and enforceable throughout the country. A prenuptial agreement, or a prenup for short, lays down exactly what will happen if the marriage ends in divorce. Who gets what, and who has to pay what to who. And they're very popular, especially among celebrities. You've probably heard in high-profile divorce cases, was there a prenup, what did it say? And among the rich, people who've got lots of property that they don't want to lose if the marriage breaks up. In England, the law is moving in the same direction. There's a lot of discussion among legal people in England and Wales about whether prenups should be legally enforceable here. They're already recognised as having some force in courts of law. But that's the direction it's moving in. And some would say, if you go into marriage without a prenup, especially if you have a lot of property to protect, you're a fool. You'll only have yourself to blame when divorce leaves you broke, as well as broken-hearted. And so with 42% of marriages in the UK ending in divorce, surely it's wiser to plan exactly how these things will end before you begin. Shouldn't we be advising couples approaching marriage to be realistic, to be prepared for divorce and what happens afterwards? Factor it into their thinking. And when the marriage becomes a struggle, surely the right thing to do is just to say, okay, we'll call it a day. So could this old book in front of us possibly have anything useful to say to us about this very topical issue? Well, if we were transported back to first century Israel, we'd find ourselves in a world where the topic of divorce and how, when and why you could and should divorce was very much under debate. There were people then who liked nothing better than a good legal argument about divorce, just like today. Yes, the world was different, but nothing really changes. In the Jewish society where Jesus lived, there are two main schools of thought about divorce, on how they should interpret the detailed wording of the law of Moses that their lives were based on. There's the strict school of Rabbi Shammai, and they say that a man can divorce his wife only on the grounds of adultery or something equally serious. And then there is the more relaxed school of Rabbi Hillel, who says you can divorce your wife for more or less anything. If she annoys you, you can let her go. If she's embarrassing, you can send her away. If her cooking is not up to the standards of Bake Off, you can send her away. It's that easy. And both these groups agree that divorce is something to be accepted and legislated for. So that when the Jewish Talmud, this great kind of compendium of Jewish law and commentary and thought, when they put that together about 100 years after Jesus' time, it will contain an entire volume of legal definitions about how you serve a bill of divorce. Big fat book, that thick, and that's all it's about. Sounds like obsession, maybe it was. But that certificate is the only protection that a divorced woman has in that society. It declares that she's free of any obligation to her husband, and it contains the words, "You are now free to go and marry any man." Not a lot of protection, but it's better than nothing. Women themselves are not able to initiate a divorce. So this is the background when Jesus' old friends, the Pharisees, show up again and challenge him on the subject of divorce. Verses 1 to 3, look at those again. When Jesus had finished saying these things, he left Galilee and went into the region of Judea to the other side of the Jordan. Large crowds followed him and he healed them there. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason?" Matthew uses this form of words in verse 1 to signal a break. It's the start of a new phase in Jesus' ministry. He's now left Galilee behind, his homeland. He's moving on. He started on the road to Jerusalem, in fact, where he will face his death. He travels south and east across the River Jordan into the region of Judea that's called Perea. And the crowds follow, but in this story our attention is not on the crowds. The Pharisees tackle Jesus with a question. Not because they're really interested in what he has to teach them, but because they want to test him. Where does he stand on this burning question of divorce? We already know they're out to destroy him. We've read that earlier in Matthew's Gospel. We know they're after him. We know they're on his case. And in this particular case, there's a specially sinister angle to their choice of question. Here in Perea, Jesus has entered the territory of Herod Antipas. He's one of the large, complex and confusing Herod family. I can never remember which is which, but this guy is called Herod Antipas. This is where he's in charge. And not long ago, this Herod took a wife called Herodias, who was actually his brother's wife. And it was a pretty sordid business. And John the Baptist pointed out to Herod that this marriage is completely unlawful. Which is why, very close to the spot where Jesus now stands, John was arrested and later executed. So now, they're thinking, well, hey, why not try and trap Jesus into making the same kind of critical statements about Herod and his wife and his family that John did? Hey, perhaps Herod will step in and take Jesus off our backs, just like he did with John. Anyway, they want to talk to him about divorce. But as we look on through this story, we see that that's not really where Jesus wants to go. Jesus says, in effect, hey, don't let's talk about divorce. Let's talk about marriage. Let's start with that. And he puts marriage squarely in the centre of the discussion. And although our title this morning is Jesus and Divorce, that's what we'll do too. So let's get into the Bible passage and let's talk about marriage. Look with me at verses 4 to 6. So here's Jesus answering. Haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let no one separate. Quite sure there's black on the screen. It was white when I left it, but there you go. You've got it in the Bible, so that's much better. So when they want him to talk about divorce, here's what Jesus says. He goes right back to the start of everything, back to square one. And there's a lot compressed in these three verses. So let's pull out what Jesus said, put it down as a list of statements about marriage, and these will be on the screen, hopefully in colour we can actually read. What does Jesus say? One, there is a creator. Verse 4. There is someone who designed and made us, the whole human race and each one of us, a creator. And at this point, verses 4 and 5, Jesus is actually quoting from the opening chapters of Genesis, the first book in the Bible. Two, he made us male and female. Our gender is a fundamental part of who we are. It's given to us by God. It's not something that shifts around depending on how we feel. We are made male and female, equal but different, reflecting the image of God, whether we are man or woman. Three, marriage is between one man and one woman. That's the only kind of marriage the Bible recognises. Fundamental to marriage is this differentness, this complementarity between man and woman. Four, marriage comes ahead of all other family ties. It involves a decisive leaving, a separation from your parents so that your spouse is your first responsibility. Five, it's within marriage that sex belongs. It's the sexual connection that creates this one flesh union that Jesus talks about here. According to the Bible, that unique and powerful bond has to be reserved for marriage. Comes after the man and woman have got together, been joined together in marriage, that they become one flesh through the sexual union. And six, marriage is intended for life. It's set up and arranged that way by God himself. So if you undo it, if you divorce, you are undoing the work of God. Okay. Now, if we'd been speaking about this 50 years ago in this country, most of those points would have been uncontroversial. If we looked at it 20 years ago, there would have been much more dispute, but everything there would at least have seemed reasonable. Today, you don't need me to tell you, almost every one of those points cuts right against our culture. We know that. Some people would react, object violently, even to our right to say some of these things. The speed of change in what society believes has been astonishing, even within the lifetime of most of you, never mind people like me and Mark. Can the truth really change so fast? People might want to think. As Christians, we would say the truth doesn't change at all. But if this is new to you, or you don't hold to the worldview of the Bible, you may well struggle to accept this understanding of marriage. And at the very least, you need more time to process it. And I get that. We can't unpack it all now. We'd be here all day. But I want to acknowledge the difficulty and say, yes, well, we'd love to talk it through with you. There's a lot here that is difficult. In fact, even people who've grown up among Christians all their lives, which is quite a few of us, may be taken aback when you see some of these points set out. Because from Monday to Saturday, we hear something different. Because the power of the media and our culture is bombarding us so strongly with a very different message. We're responsible to no one but ourselves. There's no one out there that we answer to. Gender is fluid. It can change. Marriage is between anyone and anyone else. It starts and finishes whenever we like. Sex is for whenever you please and whenever it feels good. But this is what Jesus says. These are the Maker's good instructions. This is the way we're created to be. This is how human life and society works best and flourishes well. And it's good. It's not a cage. It's freedom. Ultimately, living outside this God-given framework will damage us. Might feel good for a while, but the end is destruction. Now, some of you, looking at some of these points, you may have a different reaction. You may be feeling right now, yep, I'm convinced that's true. I believe that. But when I look at that, I can see that I've failed. I haven't lived up to what Jesus is saying here. You may be responding with that kind of sense of failure. In that case, we want to say, well, the great good news about being a Christian is that there is always hope. Yeah, we recognise what sin is. We recognise what turning away from God's best way is. But there's always hope. And why have we focused in the first half of this service on the love of God to us in Christ? Why have we focused on that? Because of this. His love is the greatest love. His love is the most important love. His love can take our brokenness and bring healing and restoration. With him there's always hope. So as we go through this message, if you're feeling like a failure, if you're feeling that you have screwed up in this area, well, firstly, you're in very good company, because most of us have. But look to Christ, because there's hope in him. There is always hope in him, wherever you are right now. And as I say, feel free to come back on any of these points afterwards. But now that we've looked at what Jesus says, what does this mean for married people, and what does it mean for single people? Because Jesus speaks to both. First, what does this mean if you're married? Look at verses 7 to 9. Why then, they asked, these Pharisees, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. So the Pharisees think, Jesus seems to be ruling out divorce completely. That can't be right. We've got all these rules about it. Come on, Jesus, why did Moses tell us to send our wives away and give them that certificate? And Jesus says, yeah, Yes, Moses did say that, but it wasn't a command, as if divorce is something you should expect to happen. It was a permission, because people are so hard-hearted. It was never God's intention, it was not his original plan, that marriage should end in divorce. Divorce, in other words, is always a departure from God's ideal. Divorce can only take place for the strongest of reasons, sexual immorality. The Greek word is porneia. But Jesus is talking about here has to refer to adultery, breaking the marriage bond. Actually, he isn't concerned here to give a fresh list of regulations about divorce. The Jewish law recognised that desertion, which would include abuse, might also be a reason for divorce. The point Jesus is making is that divorce is a last resort when all possibility of reconciliation and healing has been exhausted, when there is no other possible course left. And yes, as Christians, we may have a range of views about precisely when divorce and then remarriage can be right. We have a lot of other biblical material to go on, as well as this passage. And at Kensington, we have our position on this, which we've set out in a policy paper so that our people know where we stand. If you're a church member, you have a copy of that. If not, we can give you one. It's not a secret if you want to know exactly what our policy is in this church. But this is BC3, and I don't want to dwell too much on divorce and remarriage because it's not the issue most of us are facing. And our other two congregations have been reflecting on this during the week. That will be different. So here's the message for those of us who are married. In our marriages, we need to be working out the positive, beautiful picture Jesus gives us here. When we acknowledge and honour our Creator, he's in charge. He's in charge of our marriage. We answer to him. We honour him in the way that we live out our married lives. Where we can live out the differentness of male and female and the different roles we have in the marriage. Instead of trying to squash that difference or wish it away, we'll recognise and help each other to live it. Where we will enjoy intimacy and express our sexuality in the special way that only marriage allows. God gave us our sexuality and it's good. And because marriage is a secure place, we won't need to worry all the time if the relationship is about to break up, because we covenanted to one another for life and we have that understanding. So we're not always performing for one another. We're resting in the security that we have because it's a covenant that we've made together. And knowing that gives us security for our sexual relationship. It gives us security to have kids and bring them up where they will be secure and where they will have both manhood and womanhood modelled to them every day. And when marriage gets tough, and it does because we're all sinful, we won't think of walking away. We will have our furious rows, and we do. But we won't think of trying to end the marriage. What God has joined together, let no one separate. The trials of marriage, like all the other trials we face in this life, God can use for our good. If we're Christians, he will use those hard times to make us more like Jesus. That is his agenda. So the challenge, in short, is to love your wife or your husband with a devotion that is unique, exclusive, and permanent, to thank God for them every day, to point them constantly to Jesus Christ. Because even the best marriage has limitations, and we need to hear this as well. Marriage is a good gift from the Lord, and we're very grateful for it, but we're not to idolize it. We sometimes use slightly dangerous language about marriage. Being married is not what makes you complete. It can't do that. Completeness for you and me comes from being united with Jesus Christ, not with your husband or wife. Your spouse is not your other half, as though you're less than a person without them. If anyone deserves to be called our other half. It's the Lord Jesus, once you know him. Because he's the one who will make you complete. And that brings us neatly onto the second application. What does this mean if you're single? And I'm using single here, as Jesus does, in the old sense of not married. Okay? I hope that's clear. Look at verses 10 to 12. The disciples said to him, "If this is the situation between a husband and wife, it's better not to marry." Jesus replied, "Not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born that way, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others. And there are those who choose to live like eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept it." Only Matthew includes this section, so we obviously thought it was important. The disciples have heard what Jesus has said about marriage and divorce, and they respond, "Wow, that's how it is. If marriage is so serious and it's such a challenge, if it's so hard to get out of it, it's probably better never to get into it in the first place." And Jesus says, verse 11, "You could be right." This verse is a little bit mysterious, but that's basically what he's saying. Yes, for some people, it's true that they can't or won't get married. For some people, it's God's plan that they should not marry. Then he goes on to use some fairly brutal language, and some of it will sound brutal, some of this. A eunuch is a man who's been castrated. To say that, if you don't know, that's what a eunuch is. And that wasn't quite as shocking an idea in biblical times as it sounds for us, because it wasn't that uncommon. Eunuchs were in demand, actually, for a range of responsible activities. Being a eunuch could be a gateway to high office, like the Ethiopian eunuch we meet in Acts chapter 8, who was basically the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the courts of Ethiopia. You might remember that story, Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. So for them, this doesn't sound quite as shocking as it does for us. But still, the key point of being a eunuch, of course, is that you're unable to have sex. And in this passage, Jesus is clearly using eunuch as a metaphor for celibacy, whether for a man or a woman, refraining from sexual activity. And it seems that Jesus is using this particular picture to underline the fact that singleness is very often costly, painful, and unwelcome. We know that. Most people want to be married. So in this passage, Jesus is not saying that being single and celibate is easy, but he does say that for some people it is good and right. And in verse 12, Jesus describes three different kinds of people. Some were born eunuchs, which means they are constitutionally unable to marry. That might cover a whole variety of reasons which rule out sexual intimacy, including people who are attracted to the same sex instead of the opposite sex. Marriage won't be an option for them. I said it would sound brutal. Then some have been made eunuchs by others. In the context of the times, that includes people who've literally been operated on. But for whatever reason, singleness has been forced on them. And then thirdly, there are those who've made themselves eunuchs. Text literally says that, made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. That is, people who've deliberately chosen a life of singleness and celibacy so that they can serve the Lord more effectively. And there are plenty of people, men and women, who've made just that choice. Some of the great pioneer missionaries deliberately turned their backs on marriage so that they would be free to obey God's call on their lives. Others, mostly women, simply went to the mission field, single, knowing that their chances of finding a husband while they were there were remote. But it was a sacrifice they were willing to make for the sake of the kingdom. If you're single, it is easier to live a life that is simple, flexible, and mobile. There's a passage in 1 Corinthians where Paul says a lot about marriage and singleness. We could have picked up a lot of references from there today, but just listen to this one. It's 1 Corinthians 7, 32 to 34. And if all the references are blank, you might need to turn to it, but I'll just read it anyway. I would like you to be free from concern, Paul says. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. And his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. See what he's saying there. For a Christian who is totally committed to serving the Lord, which really should mean all of us, being single has great advantages, you see. Three possible reasons for being single. Now, Jesus doesn't say it's good to be single because you're commitment shy and you won't take the decision to trust a potential spouse. He doesn't say that. That is not a good reason to stay single. Okay? And he doesn't say it's good to be single because you're too selfish to share your life with someone else. Those are not good reasons to stay single. But singleness can be right, and it can be good. And we need to say a bit more about singleness. In a culture that is sex mad, in a society that thinks you're either diseased or deprived if you're not sexually active, we need to say more. And the church is often not held here. Centuries ago, celibacy was thought to be higher and more spiritual than marriage. But today in the church, we've gone to the other extreme. We celebrate marriage, and that's great, but when do we ever celebrate singleness? If it's a gift from God, which it is, we should celebrate singleness too. Let's remind ourselves that the Lord Jesus never married. He lived and died a virgin. And he was the most complete man who ever lived. He was the only complete man who's ever lived without ever being sexually active. One of the most helpful books I've read in the last few years is this one by Ed Shaw, The Plausibility Problem. And many of you have read it, many of us heard Ed speak at church a few months ago. Ed is a Christian pastor here in Bristol who is living a celibate life. It so happens that he is same-sex attracted, and he recognises that if the Bible is true, that means he is called to be single and celibate. But what he says in the book is helpful for all of us, whatever our sexuality and whether we're single or married. He describes a series of false steps that the church has taken in dealing with issues of sexuality. And let me share a couple of them with you. One, sex is where true intimacy is found. Answer, of course, intimacy is found in sex. That's pretty obvious. But it's also found in friendships, the kind of friendships that many of us don't have. Ed challenges us to make our friendships more intimate, more trusting. He quotes the biblical counsellor Paul Tripp here. One of the things, this is Paul Tripp, one of the things that still shocks me in counselling, even after all these years, is how little I often know about people I have counted as true friends. I can't tell you how many times in talking with friends who come to me for help that I've been hit with details of difficulty and struggle far beyond anything I could have predicted. Privatism is not just practiced by the lonely unbeliever. It is rampant in the church as well. And one of the reasons that many of our single people find it so hard to be single is that we don't do real friendship. On Facebook, you can be called a friend on the basis of a fleeting moment of remote electronic connection. That is ludicrous. I genuinely have people who are friends of mine on Facebook. Not only have I never met them, I don't even know who they are. I don't know how they got on there. But they're my friends, apparently. I have 400 friends. No, I don't. I have 5 friends, if I'm doing well. There are 10 family members on there, and I have 385 distant acquaintances. As a church, if we want to make singleness something more than a problem, we need to rediscover friendship. We need friends who know us through and through as we really are. One more comment from Ed that might help you. I think this is interesting. He says, my personal experience is that the power of sexual temptation lessens the more time I spend among friends with whom I am non-sexually intimate. Go and read the book. Here's the second false step I want to highlight. Celibacy is bad for you. That's the message of the media, of Hollywood in particular, and sometimes it's also the message the church itself gives. Celibacy is something to be avoided at all costs. And of course, if we believe that, we'll find it very hard as a church not to accept same-sex marriage, because celibacy will look like an intolerable burden to place on anyone. It will just feel so cruel to say that. But that's not the Bible's view. Jesus was celibate. Paul describes its advantages in 1 Corinthians 7, and he's clearly celibate himself, at least by the time he writes that letter he is. And it was pretty countercultural in those days too. Celibacy itself is not bad for you. Yes, it has its pitfalls and its pains. Actually, so does sex. And having sex or not makes no difference at all to your relationship with God. It sounds blindingly obvious, but it probably needs saying in our society. So what kind of church do we want to be? What is our vision? We want to be a church where marriage is recognised as good, where we protect it, we celebrate it, we enjoy it, we live it lifelong. We're faithful. Our marriages model faithfulness, the faithfulness of God in Christ. And to be a church where singleness is seen as good. Both marriage and singleness are good gifts. That is the only kind of gift that God gives out. He doesn't give out bad gifts that are booby-trapped. He only gives us good gifts. And we want to be a church where friendships go deep. If you're married now, that is your gift from God. And if you're single now, even if you long for marriage, that is your gift, at least for now. And it's good. Above all, we need to know that our greatest need is not a successful marriage or to have great sex. Our greatest need, whoever we are, is to know Jesus Christ and to know him better and to love him more. If you don't know Jesus Christ, quite possibly this message won't have made a lot of sense to you. That's because living as married or single, as we've been describing, rests entirely on knowing him. If you don't know him, we'd love to introduce you. Jesus Christ can clear away the rubbish and the failure of our past. And he can reconcile you to God. That's what he does. God, your creator. And whether you're married or single, he can give you a life with meaning, with purpose, with hope for the future. Because the greatest marriage of all hasn't happened yet. It's still to come. It's the marriage between Jesus Christ and his people, the church. Jesus came all the way from heaven to seek out his bride. And at the cross where he was executed, he paid the marriage price for us. He bought us to be his own. That's what Jesus has done. And the great marriage is coming ahead of us. And whether we're married or single now, if we belong to him, we'll all be part of that day. And that's the true marriage, of which all other marriages are just a pale shadow. And if we belong to him, yeah, we're part of that. I'm going to hand back to Tim.